From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobody's above internet scam attacks. Today, it's Google trying to clean up after online scammers mimicked Google to fish for access to email accounts and info. Maybe they got you. It's a jungle out there. This hour On Point, the Google attack and how to protect yourself from the latest moves by online scammers and identity thieves. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Were you spearfished yesterday? How do you keep your guard up? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Brian Funk, technology reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering the Google phishing attack. That's with a PH. Brian, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
These have gone on forever, phishing attacks. What was different about the Google attack? Why is it getting so much attention, Brian?
Well, this one in particular was really sophisticated in that it tricked people into logging into their actual Google accounts before giving access to the attacker. And ordinarily, most phishing attacks can, you know, have some telltale signs that they're maybe not legit, such as having email addresses that look like they're suspicious, or you know, having email content that may be misspelled. In this case, though, it all looked above board, which likely tricked a bunch of people into clicking who otherwise might not have.
Google Docs was right in the middle of this. For people who may not use it, or for those who do, remind us what that is and how that was employed here to gain people's trust.
Sure. So Google Docs is essentially Google's version of Microsoft Word. It's their word processing app that exists on the internet. And through your Google account, you can log in and create documents and share them with other people. And in this case, the sharing function is how a lot of folks were kind of duped into clicking into this attack. What the attack did was to it showed up in your inbox as an email saying someone wants to share a document with you on Google Docs. And when you click into that the email, it would give you a little option to allow access to an application called Google Docs. Now, most people, you know, looking at this might reasonably think, okay, Google Docs is a well-known application. Of course, I should give it access. In reality, what the attacker was doing was posing as Google Docs, and when you gave access to Google Docs, you also gave the attacker access to all of your account data, such as your address book and other information associated with your Google account, which then allowed the attacker to message everyone in your address book and then perpetuate that attack to other people.
And so, when you first, if anyone who got this, when they first got it, you said it, something comes in from someone. But this, because this is coming out of contactless, this may well be someone you know.
Absolutely. You know, for example, I myself actually got a number of these emails from people who, you know, are in my contact book. But because I wasn't actively working on any Google Docs with them, I knew that perhaps this was going to be a fraudulent email and didn't click. But, you know, perhaps you were expecting an email from you know, a partner or a work associate or something, and that may have been, you know, your opportunity to make a big mistake.
Now, it wasn't that they were really into Google's software, right? This wasn't really Google Docs they're dealing with here. It was a page mimicking, or that looked just like it would have come from Google. Am I right?
Well, the initial page that you accessed did look a lot like Google Docs, or that did look a lot like an email that you might have received from Google Docs. But when you actually click through on the button in that email, it takes you to a legitimate tool that is actually operated by Google, and that's one of the reasons why this is this attack was so sophisticated. It actually used a loophole, I guess, in Google's software that, you know, other third-party apps routinely use that, you know, don't abuse this by saying, hey, you know, if you wanted to, you know, if you're using a calendar app, Google, you'd use this Google tool to authorize access for this calendar app to access your Google Calendar. So that using that same technique, this attacker was able to trick a lot of people into, you know, allowing access to what they thought was Google Docs, but which was actually not.
But part of the innovation here was so simple, it was just looking graphically, design-wise, it looked like something that would have come from Google.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is another reason why it was so hard to detect. You know, all the icons looked relatively similar. All of the language that, you know, you might have received in the email, that seemed relatively similar. And so it was very easy to you know, be mistaken into thinking that what you were actually seeing was from Google.
I mean, just at the top level here, I've wondered for years about this. When things show up and it says it's from, you know, you name it, Microsoft or Apple or Google. And I'm sitting there, you know, they often bring you buttons that have consequence when you press them. And I find myself judging just on the basis of the graphics that, yeah, this is legit. But graphics should be very easy to duplicate, to fake, shouldn't they?
Well, yeah, you know, in the case of Google and a lot of these tech companies, in fact, simplicity is the key. You know, they've designed their websites to be as minimalist or as visually simple as can be in order to encourage people to use them more easily. And so when you implement some of these design principles, I guess it also incentivizes, you know, hackers and attackers into mimicking some of that stuff. Although, you know, I think this is sort of one of the first times we've seen an attacker do something like this with a major provider such as Google.
Surprising in a way that there hasn't been more. Talk about the harm that could come from this. Okay, you've done this and now they've got into your contact list and it's perpetuating their scam because now they've got a lot more email addresses and they can appear that they've come from you. These requests, but where does the harm come in? That's the spreading of this malware, whatever they've got in there. Where's the harm?
Right. Well, in this case, you know, it seems like at a surface level, the harm was relatively limited in that, you know, all the malware did was to look through your address book and replicate those sharing emails to everyone in your address book, which, you know, all things considered, you know, doesn't seem like any money was lost or, you know, your financial accounts are still secure. But, you know, in the broader scheme of things, you know, that account data is very valuable to a company like Google. You know, obviously, having all of those contact addresses or having other aspects of your Google account become public or leaked to the public, you know, companies spend billions and billions of dollars accumulating this data so that they can use it for targeted advertising or selling it to third-party marketers. And so there is kind of a financial aspect of this for the company that is potentially significant. And then the other thing is, you know, simply having your address book leaked out into the public could be very dangerous for, you know, folks who, you know, maybe they're lawyers or work closely with disadvantaged or you know, populations who could be threatened if that information were to become public. And so there's a potential harm in that respect as well.
Brian Fung with the Washington Post, technology reporter there. I'm so glad you're with us today. Thank you. Stand by there in Washington. Also from Washington right now, Alina Selyuk is here. She's technology reporter at NPR and the host of the All Tech Considered blog. Alina, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How do you see the potential harm in this big Google email attack yesterday? Is it just about mailing lists or is there more harm that could somehow unfold from this?
I think a lot of it is hypothetical and a lot of it depends on how people react. I was thinking about kind of the level of trust that people have when they use a company like Google and all of their services. Google is, as we know, one of the largest tech companies out there in the world and in the country. Many, many people have come to depend on Google quite vitally for their work, for their personal lives. We really do entrust a lot of our information to Google. And in this case, what we are witnessing, as Brian just laid out, Google played you know, sort of a median role in this attack or in this attempt at an attack anyway. And, you know, to whatever extent they could have prevented it, it's a little unclear to me. But the point that I walked away from this is that it's a good reminder that even the largest companies are susceptible. The varying levels to which various companies have suffered attacks of this sort or another sort are there. So we could debate that. But I walked away thinking, oh, yeah, this is a reminder. You know what? We trust a lot Gmail. We trust a lot to Google Docs. We trust a lot to Google Spreadsheets.
Sure.
You know, many people do their
every day, all over.
And again, it's unclear. Much of what happened here is like human error, very basic phishing attempt that somebody clicked a link, somebody made that choice, and that started a daisy chain. Nonetheless, what could have Google done? Maybe this is a conversation that will actually this time heat up and we'll talk more about.
Well, we're here, but as you say, so much of our lives on the internet in the digital world depend on trust, especially with the big companies like Google, Apple, and so on. I mean, will you pause for a moment the next time somebody wants to share a Google Doc with you, Alina, and think, wow, do I have to call them on the telephone and ask me if they sent me a Google Doc, or how do I verify
this is real? It's funny that You put this as this sort of like incredible thing, and yet this was something that people should have been doing all along. So for somebody who has been covering cyber for a while, and I'm sure Brian would agree with this as well, this is actually, in fact, the mantra that cyber experts have been saying for, I mean, phishing is like the oldest scam.
Yeah, but where's the efficiency of the web? If every time someone sends you a Google Doc, you have to pick up your cell phone and call them and say, hey, Alina, did you send me a Google Doc that I can now click on? And you know, I mean, that would be ridiculous.
I do that. I legitimately do that. I might be one of the weird people out there, but that is sort of the attitude that I've taken. Don't click links unless, and sometimes I will email a person back and say, hey, if this is actually, the first thing to do, let's go back to that. The first thing to do is to check the legitimacy of the email address from which you're getting a link. And the second thing is check back with them and say, hey, did you mean to send me this attachment? What's in it? Should I actually click on it?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Google email attack and how to protect yourself from online scams, plunder, identity theft. Brian Fung is with us from the Washington Post, technology reporter there. He knows a thing or two about all this. So does Alina Selyukh, technology reporter at NPR, host of All Tech Considered, the blog there, both from Washington. You can join us as well in this hour. Has this one, this Google attack, hit you? Are you always on guard when you're online? Have you been hit by scammers, identity thieves? Tell us your story. And what do you do to protect yourself? I mean, if you don't, the consequences can be really lousy. Here's Mark Alfinez. His identity was stolen earlier this year. Hackers got into it with his bank and used his personal information to gain access to his account. They changed his password, word name and username, and then drained his and his children's accounts. He believes his personal details were stolen in the 2015 hack of the Office of Personnel Management. Here he is talking with CBS This Morning in February.
There's nothing I could have done to stop it. It was the bank that let them in. They had all my pedigree information, social security card, driver's license, wife's maiden name, all that stuff. But they couldn't pass the phone password. But since they had all that other information, they still let them in.
Once they're in there, once they've got it, things can get hairy. In a hurry, Brian, Alina calls for you, Ron, in Detroit, Michigan. Ron, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I called because I got zapped yesterday, and it was within a day or so of it was in the name of a person with whom I just had a phone conversation setting up a calendar commitment, so it seemed entirely legitimate that she was sending me some information in connection with that. And but as soon as I don't remember giving access to the Google account, but I got a flash on my Samsung phone screen. My question is, I wasn't doing this on a computer, but I did it on my phone. Is it vulnerable in the same way as if I had done that on the computer? I did check later on. I immediately sent a message to my friend saying, did you just send me a document?
Yep.
She was able to confirm later on that no, she thought she'd been hacked. And also, I did check the address, and it was a very hokey looking thing with a bunch of H's at the beginning of it.
That's the one.
Are you just as vulnerable on the phone as you would be on a computer, I guess is my question.
Okay, Ron, let us pick it up. Brian Fung, what do you say?
Yeah, well, because this attack happens through your Google account, which is sort of by definition accessible whether you're on your computer or your phone. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is potentially something that could affect you on all sorts of devices. All that needs to happen is for the attacker to get into your Google account, and then you've been affected, and messages from your address book are probably spreading throughout the web.
Is there any evidence at this point, Brian, that it's anything more than tapping your contact list?
Not that we've seen, but potentially this affects as many as a million users of Gmail. Google said that this attack affects 0.1% of its roughly billion users, so that's how that gets to the million user figure. So that's a lot of people, and potentially that's a lot of data.
Is it still out there and at work doing its evil deed, I guess, or has Google bottled it up at this point, Brian?
Well, Google says that it acted within about an hour to put a stop to it by essentially clamping down on the Google account that was perpetrating this attack. It's also blacklisted some of the IP addresses that were associated with this attack. For most people, the worst of it appears to be over. But that said, as we were just discussing, you always sort of need to be on guard for the next attack or the next hack.
Let's go to Al in Richmond Hill, Georgia. Al, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Great. What's your experience, Al?
Yes. I, as a small business owner, I use Google Docs quite a bit. The one thing that I do is that when I send someone a document, whether it's a spreadsheet or Word or text document,
yep,
I let them know that I am sending them a document that's associated with Google Docs. And then either by a text message or a phone call, or I'll send them an email. And then I will follow up with them to see if they had any issues, that they get it, that it make it through their spam filter, so on and so forth. So that's kind of like how I handle it. But I haven't personally gotten hit by any of the attacks coming out of of Google or any other matter for that matter.
Lucky for you, but you're already doing that sort of multiple stage authentication just on your own there. But Alina, I guess if they have your contact list, they could send you a preliminary email that looked like it was from someone you knew well saying, hey, I'm about to send you a Google Docs, that way. And then the next one comes with the phishing expedition in it.
I guess theoretically or hypothetically that could be the case. I think that would take a lot of coordination on a hacker's behalf.
Would it really? It's just two emails instead of one. Send a preliminary one saying, "Hey, heads up, buddy. Here comes some Google Doc for you." And next one is the
right.
Bad actor.
I think in this case, or in most cases with phishing scams, what you're looking at is sort of a crime of efficiency and crime of mass. Mm-hmm. Sort of you bombard as many people and just, a portion of those people will click the link without looking at it, will click the link without checking the email address in case it looks fishy. No pun intended,
yep,
but probably actually intended. And so in this case, you just sort of blast this email to all the contacts and then somebody will click, and so it will keep perpetrating as Brian had described earlier. So I guess theoretically that is possible. I don't think we've seen that. I think that would be sort of a new level of sophistication that we haven't seen, but also more chances of people actually noticing that there is a scam happening. And so theoretically it could also be stopped before the second email would even arrive.
Yeah, more touches, more exposure. Anne in Burlington, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was telling the folks earlier that I was lucky, if you want to call it that, in that my husband's company, a large company here across town in Burlington, got hit pretty hard by that yesterday. And he called me and said, if you get an email from anybody and that says hhhh@mailinator.com, don't open it. So fortunately, I was lucky because, in fact, a few minutes later, an email from a good friend who would send me a Google Doc came across my desk, and I took a look at the email address, and in fact, it was that bogus address. So I didn't even open it, and I deleted it. But, I was, as I say, I was one of the lucky ones. It was coming from someone whom I would have expected a doc from. I would have checked the email anyway.
Yeah.
And as Aline suggested, get in touch with that person. But, it's just so easy to overlook that if you're in a rush or doing something else.
Like a close call for you there, Anne. Brian Fung, I'm looking at a screen grab of one of these yesterday, and it's pretty simple. This was sent to somebody that's blocked out, but you can see the address of the sender, and it's this long HHHHHHHH, whatever it was. And then they say, so-and-so has invited you to view the following document. Now, if I looked up there and I saw that it had come from this bizarre-looking HHHHH, isn't that heads up enough, Brian, to say, wait, something's weird here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're certainly not expecting to receive an email from, a sender like that, or if you don't know someone who has an email address like that, that's certainly one of the telltale signs that you might be at risk of a phishing attack. In this case, Mailinator, if you're not familiar with it, it's a service that allows you to obtain and use a temporary or disposable email address that then expires after a certain amount of time. In this case, the emails appeared to have been not originating from this address, but actually being sent to this address, perhaps, for the attacker to keep track of who had, been receiving these sharing emails, the malicious emails. So while it seems like Mailinator might have been involved somehow, it actually seems like more likely that it was, kind of incidental to the actual crime.
But a funny-looking address that it came from. Brian Fung and Alina Seljuk there in Washington, please stand by. Justin Kappos joins us now via Skype from Hamburg, Germany, professor in the Computer Science and Engineering Department at NYU's Tandon School of Engineering. Justin Kappos in Hamburg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What did you think of this attack? What's remarkable about it? What's every day?
There's a couple of things that are pretty interesting about this, and I want to just kind of build on a couple of things that were said earlier. So, it did actually turn out that this attack isn't so much about phishing as you might think. It's really an attack that's about apps, and really what happens is Google has this kind of app store marketplace that works around Google Drive, and so different things that different companies and organizations want to make neat drawing programs or other things like that fit into that app store. And that's separate from like the Android Play Store or your iPhone's app store or things like this.
Okay.
And so what's happening here is people were getting sent messages and their messages, when you click on something and it tells you the thing about the Google Docs, you should never see that if you're a Google Docs user. Because you are already using Google Drive and those other services yourself. So
right.
If I go and I send one of the other people here a doc, then they won't see it. They'll just see a link.
So this was already a heads up if you were very familiar with this and really paying attention that this isn't the way things normally roll.
Right, right. And so I think a lot of people, you should be suspicious if you think you already have an app installed or you think you're using an app and it needs new permissions or it acts like you don't have it installed. That is a big telltale for users.
So
one other thing is
yes,
that
please.
The app did actually have permission to read and delete emails and do things like this. But according to Google, the person who wrote the application didn't actually use those permissions on any of the accounts that they compromised. They only used the ability to look at the contact list to send further emails out. And Google has since blocked all of that. So apparently it's something where they would have had the ability to get any sensitive information you have in your email, like your tax documents, to reset passwords for other accounts, maybe your bank account, or get those intimate photos that you sent to your significant other. All those things were accessible to this to the person who went and made this malicious app that launched this very successful phishing attack, but Google stepped in within an hour and was able to revoke that access.
When Google says that they managed to shut that down, do you believe them, Justin? I mean, this is a PR problem for them. Or are they, I guess, maybe they have no choice but to be straightforward about it, because if someone's stuff was ripped off, that might emerge later. Do you trust Google to give us the full story on what might have been exposed here?
Well, I've seen a lot of companies that will say very hand-wavy things when they have a breach, and they'll kind of talk around the issue and things like this. And Google was very forthright about what access they say the person didn't have and what they say they did have. So I'm inclined to believe them. And also, technically, it makes sense that they could stop this very quickly. So it's completely plausible and believable that an engineer made a very minor tweak inside of a database, and all of a sudden, it was all shut off.
We're looking at the Google email attack and what we can learn from it. Let's go to Kathy in Bloomington, Illinois. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I got hacked yesterday, and when I got online and started researching a little bit, one suggestion I thought that was very helpful was to go into my Google account and check my permission to for apps and make sure that there wasn't a app that was appearing that was had permission to get into my account, and there wasn't. But I thought that was something that was very helpful, and it said that, you know, especially if it said that there was an app called Google Docs that had permission to access my account, that I should remove it. And then, of course, the other suggestion was to change my password for my Google, for my Gmail, was the other suggestion. So, but the permission thing I wouldn't have thought of. So I thought that was a helpful suggestion.
Kathy, I have not messed around with that page much. Was it complicated? Was it straightforward when you got in there? Was it easy to do?
No, it wasn't at all. In fact, the sites that I found it on, and it was on several sites because, of course, when I Googled phishing, Google Doc, phishing Google Docs, a bunch of stories came up, and several of those articles actually had the link right in the article that took you to that in your Google, in your Gmail. Took you right to that that section, so it was super easy to find it from those articles.
Sounds like.
And then I went into my Gmail also, and I searched with the help thing. I just searched permission apps, and it took me to that section also. And it was showing for me. It was showing no apps had permission to access my account.
We'll try and put that link up at our website, onpointradio.org, Kathy, and I really appreciate your call. That's the way to get in there and manage that account actively so you're less vulnerable. Let me get one more right here. Chris in Boston. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. One thing that I wanted to mention is that a lot of K-12 schools are using Google Docs for assignments. So
sure.
We've got kids 10, 11, 12 years old trying to manage these accounts. They have school-issued Gmail accounts, and more than half of my kids' assignments with homework are posted on Google Docs and worked on and turned in through Google Docs. They share with the teacher. They share with the other students. So I think that's a real vulnerability there.
It's a lot to ask of a 10 or 11-year-old to be the security guardian for the whole household's computer profile, Chris.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Justin, what about that? I'm sure that's happening all over the country, schools and teachers using Google Docs, and here the kids are very accustomed to going in. Now, maybe they'd be savvy enough to recognize something a little bit different, but maybe they wouldn't.
Yeah, this was rather hard to spot unless you kind of poked around. There were ways that you could notice that something was amiss, even if you hadn't had Google Docs and didn't notice the HHHHH mailinator address in the address bar.
Mm-hmm.
And one is that on the page that Google sent you to ask you for that information, if you know that had that very real Google Docs link and that very real information there, there's a little drop-down menu you can click on there that tells you more information about the developer. And then it's just some like random guy's email address, which you know Google wouldn't use that if they were distributing that as an official app. So what I think is likely to happen is I think Google is very likely to make a change out of this to make that information much more prominent, much easier to see, and also for them to have some sort of system that tries to filter these app names that people can create in a much smarter way.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We were talking about that Google email attack yesterday and how to protect yourself from online scams, plunder, identity theft. Brian Fung is with us from The Washington Post. Alina Selyuk from NPR and the All Tech Considered blog there. Justin Kapos is with us from NYU's Tandon School of Engineering, Computer Science and Engineering Department there. He's with us today from Hamburg, Germany. You can join us as well. Were you hit yesterday? Did you know how and why? Were you aware it was even going on? And what about earlier scams? Have you had passwords broken or stolen? Have you had accounts hacked, bank accounts? Who's got time to perpetrate all this mischief? And do you think you're just too low profile to be targeted? Are you sure? Lots of interesting feedback online. Justin writes to us, I'm a teacher. This is on Twitter. I immediately thought it was suspicious, talking about the Google attack yesterday. Some of my older coworkers, not so much. Generational skepticism, Justin writes to us. Monica says, I received one of these yesterday, supposedly from a former colleague. However, I knew he never communicated that way, so I was suspicious. I contacted him and asked. He confirmed it was not from him. I deleted. Beware, all caps. Well, Emily says, I got it yesterday morning before hearing anything about it. It looked really obviously like a spam to her, she says. Both the random sender and the HHH recipient, and my email was on blind copy. No message, just click this link. I'm a little stumped why so many people fell for it. It's sort of the equivalent of, hey, get in my white van because I have some puppies. Ooh, that's creepy. But all right, Emily, I get it. Emily's eyes wide open there. But, you know, people have busy lives. And Tanya writes to us, Alina. She says, I got it from my kid's track coach. I opened it thinking it was this year's statistics. I didn't know I had it until I got bounce backs from closed email accounts. I posted on Facebook to not open it. By then, it was too late. I started getting the same document back from people I'd sent it to who opened it. Frustrating? Yes. Having to change passwords? Still a pain in the tush. I mean, is it that surprising that somebody in a busy life would think, you know, here it is from the kid's track coach. You want to look at the stats? In you go, Alina.
Yeah, it's very, very easy to do that. And sometimes you will just sort of, you know, I will speak from my personal experience, okay. And I will say this, will admit this publicly.
Walk of shame here, right?
I have fallen for it. Not for this particular scam, yeah. It was another one, yeah. And it ended up being quite innocuous. But sometimes when you're used to getting emails, when you're used to getting emails from strangers, when you're used to doing stuff on your phone really fast, it's very easy to slip up and click a link click a link that you haven't verified, mm-hmm. sort of actually read through to make sure that it's an actual website, or open an attachment, which was my case, and that's the lesson I learned. And since then, as I mentioned earlier, I just don't open attachments until I confirm that the person intended to send me something legitimate. I really wanted to say thanks to a caller earlier who said how to undo this deed. Like, if you actually did download or give permission, excuse me, to this bogus app, how to undo the damage. And in this case, there are a few guides online. If you just Google it, Vice has it, New York Times has it, to go through the permissions page and take back the permissions to this bogus Google Doc app. That was the advice that I heard yesterday. And maybe others can chime in with their advice on best password practices. But I did want to point out the two-factor authentication. I think you'd brought it up earlier, yep. in the conversation, is a huge deal. And it's sort of, it's a hassle for some people. I know a lot of people don't like it, but it is one way, at least, to create an extra layer between you and whoever wants to attempt to pretend to be like you and log into your account, even if they stole your username and password. Two-factor authentication means that they have to have a second factor, maybe access to your phone or access to another app, in order to get into your accounts and try to steal some valuable stuff if we're talking, you know, credit card information, banking information, any kind of personal,
yeah.
details.
Well, I want to step back and look at all the measures that people might take, but let's start with the very basics. We've got a call here from Dothan, Alabama. Everly is on the line. Hi, Everly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I did get the email yesterday, and I deleted without clicking on the attachment. And so I'm curious, am I safe, or are there additional steps I need to take?
Okay, let's start from the very basics. Brian, Everly got the email. She deleted it. Is she safe?
The short answer is yes. As long as you didn't interact with it, you're probably good to go.
If she had clicked on it and just opened the email without getting into any of the Google Docs stuff. Is she good?
I would imagine yes, because the attack required you to grant access to the attacker through Google's authentication tool. So as long as you didn't grant your attacker access, then I think that you're probably on good ground.
Justin, is opening an email in itself, just opening the email, ever enough to get you in trouble? Or does it always require a further step, you know, clicking on a link or something else inside an email?
It can get you in trouble just opening an email. In this specific case, it did not. But actually, there was this thing called the I Love You virus that was out in the late 90s, early 2000s. And there were a few other variants and similar viruses that were out then, when all you had to do was open the email and it would go and read your contact information and spread. And I'd just like to kind of mention one quick thing here, which is, based on the way that this very specific attack worked, even though it was a phishing attack, and even though in phishing attacks, usually your username and password and other information like that is stolen, like your password is stolen, it doesn't appear in this particular attack as though the attacker had access to your password, because all that you did is you went through Google services and allowed their app to have access to your contacts. So based on the way that technology, which is called OAuth, works, mm-hmm. that site never gets to see your password.
So in this case, the multi-factor authentication that Alina is talking about, which is a very good idea, that is, mm-hmm. You can't log into your Gmail account without going, let's say, they'll send you a code that you've got to verify through your cell phone, something beyond just the putting in your password and being done. That wouldn't have actively come into play here, you're saying, Justin.
No, it wouldn't have helped at all,
right.
Which is one of the ironic things, because it's really one of the best things you can do. The other really good thing that the normal user can do is use what's called a password manager, which helps you have a strong random password per site. You just remember one password, you type it, and it manages unique, strong passwords for you across all your sites, and a lot of them can even synchronize across multiple different devices for you. So you can use the same login everywhere on your phone, laptop, home computer, work computer, whatever.
We don't usually do this, but let's get very particular and concrete here. Password manager, do you have some that you recommend? Do you have a company or firms? I hope it's not the one you work for or own, but...
No. I have no conflicts of interest with any of these. There's a lot of different ones like KeePass and 1Password, LastPass. That are all very popular. Other password managers are available. So I encourage users to go and Google and look around and make an informed decision.
And that way,
they're all very nice and usable.
And you have an easy one thing to remember, but your accounts, in fact, are protected by sophisticated passwords all the time.
Yes, like 16-character random passwords with uppercase, lowercase, numbers, symbols. You know, it's you can generate all those kinds of things for every single account, a unique one. If you have 1,000 accounts, it doesn't matter.
That sounds like a pretty fantastic idea. Andrew in Boston. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what do you know?
So, just echoing what the previous caller said about password managers, they're fantastic, and that two-factor wouldn't have helped in this situation. However, also, if people were using Google Inbox, there was a cross-site scripting vulnerability. So even if they had just viewed the email, it would have automatically compromised them. So that kind of compounded what was going on here.
So, and people very commonly use Inbox. You're saying all they had to do was open it then and they would have... Wait,
Right. Google Inbox is a separate product from Gmail. It's their...
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's a different view for your inbox that Google launched a couple of years ago. So that is another wrinkle to this whole problem.
Get the efficiency of that and maybe a little vulnerability at the same time. So a lot of skepticism, checking on who's sending you Google Docs. And then we come to this, to shutting it down. I mean, Justin, if somebody did do this and now they want to, so this app has been, dropped into their system and they want to get out of it, they want to get away from it, what do they do?
Well, in this case, Google has stepped in and done this for them.
Okay.
But there are lots of other cases, like there was a big hubbub about the Unroll Me issue where users were granting it access to their inbox and they didn't realize that the information that the app collected, in addition to providing them with useful views on their inbox, might also was also selling information about them to marketers. In fact, that's the reason why many people installed it, was to cut down and get themselves off of marketing lists and stuff like that. So really, you have to be very skeptical about any apps that you install. And I think it was Kathy who called in and gave all those really great points about how to go in and look at your permission settings, how to look at what apps you have installed, and just don't have anything that you don't need to have installed, and be really cautious. If something says it needs access to read and delete and send emails on your behalf and read all your past emails, I mean, you should be very concerned about what is this product? Do I really need it?
Brian Fung, this seems like a lot for individuals to take on. We look to the internet to give us efficiency here. You can spend all your time, sort of guarding your flank. Are there policy changes or changes in the way things work that could be designed or legislated even to make this a less kind of a dog-eat-dog, jungle out there?
Well, when it comes to government policies, there isn't really much in the works. The most that I could say, and think of is probably, when it comes to companies accidentally leaking data, or when companies get hacked, there are a number of state level laws that require those companies to disclose to the public when they've been breached. But those are all very different. California has some pretty strong data breach notification laws, but aside from that, there are a huge patchwork, and some lawmakers here in Washington have proposed implementing a single national standard that would try to harmonize all the 50 states' data breach notification laws. And there's a big political debate about whether that's actually a good idea and how that might actually help consumers. But in this case, it doesn't seem like that type of policy would have helped. So essentially, there are some policy levers here, but for the most part, it's always best to try to become an educated consumer and to be a discerning, to be discerning about what information you're giving up and handing over when you agree to do business with a company like Google.
Stick up for yourself and be on guard. Patrick in Austin, Texas. Patrick, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. I just want to get the perspective of some of these experts. The two-factor authentication is great, but in 5 years, 10 years, once one of these becomes popular enough, are we going to be having another one of these discussions about a third-factor authentication? And just want to know about the arms race of hacking in general in the future. I'd like to get their perspective. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for calling from Austin. Justin Kappos, where do you see this going? I mean, people's lives are more and more and more intimately rolled up in this. Now we're talking about, technology you can wear, and people talking about tapping into, longer term, tapping into our cortex, into our brains. I mean, this is going to matter. Is there a way to have a more general environment of security when it comes to our tapping into the internet and it's tapping into us?
Sure. Yeah. It's really easy. Don't buy things with technology that you don't actually need. I see a lot of the stuff about smart kettles and smart, refrigerators and all this other stuff. And if you were to go to ask me how much, what would you pay for a smart kettle? I'd ask you, well, how much is a normal kettle? And if you tell me a normal kettle is $10, then I'd pay like $2 for a smart kettle. Because frankly, like I don't need the functionality. I don't want someone else to be able to be remote and know whether or not I'm in my apartment
making
that
tea
day
in
or
the
not,
morning.
Or whether I'm out of town. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I'm out of town, as I am right now, then, hey, that's something that people are now aware of.
Listen, that's great, so, Justin, but I essentially hear you saying the way to be more secure is by withdrawing or not more fully engaging with the internet. But the internet is more fully engaging with us. A lot of these products are just starting to come internet connected, whether you ask for that feature or not.
Yeah, so just be cautious about how you set it up. Be cautious about how you use it. Be very careful about permissions and things. Anything that you can do with your device, it could be done by an attacker. And an attacker can even do more things that you can do with your device, because your device may have safety precautions and things that have been built into firmware in the device, and the attacker may be able to overwrite that and cause any number of bad things to happen. There's all these very interesting futuristic articles that journalists have written talking about the horror, of what may happen with IoT in a few years. And,
Internet
as somebody
things,
on the technology side, I can see it happening.
Alina, does this mean just from here on out we have to be perpetually on our guard? The deeper the internet comes into our lives, the more vulnerability, the more wary we have to be.
I think I've been talking about the issue with lax passwords for half a decade now, and I don't think I will stop talking about that.
Yeah.
With Internet of Things, we did have another major hack, and we don't have to get into details, but it was very much directly linked to another major attack last year. And the thing we walked away knowing about the Internet of Things devices, these internet-connected stuff that we now own, is that many of them come with very basic passwords, and people don't even know that there are passwords. They don't know that they're very simple, like password 123. They don't know how to change that. And so we have been having a conversation, and by we, I mean sort of the global community of people who have touched this topic, experts, analysts, and people within companies. They've been talking about how can we make sure that the passwords are secure? What are the new steps that people can take to make sure that their information is safe? I don't know that we have all the answers, and I'm sure we will keep having this conversation for a long time.
It sounds like buyer beware, user beware. If you're breathing, beware. If you've got
your password.
Yes, if you've got any connection to the internet, beware. And if you get something from Google, a Google Docs, or anybody else, be especially aware and maybe check before you open with the sender, Alina Selyuk with NPR and All Tech Considered. Thank you very much for being with us, Alina.
Thank you.
Brian Fung at The Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Justin Kapos today from NYU's Tandon School of Engineering today from Hamburg, Germany. Thank you, Justin.
It's been a pleasure.
This is On Point.